People ask, what's the main reason behind 9/11? Now, we have taken the position from the wilderness that the Bush administration had complete foreknowledge of the attacks of September the 11th and allowed the attacks to happen for the purpose of mobilizing American and world popular support for a military occupation of Central Asia. Now, the first stumbling block that we come across with people when I try to explain this is they want just one reason. Don't bother me with two reasons why they would do this, or three. I just want one reason. And I say that's not true. The first and most important reason that I talk about is oil. But that's not all. So I say oil, and everybody says, okay, it's about oil. And I say, no, wait a minute. It's not just about oil. It's about oil and drugs. And they say, okay, it's about oil and drugs. And I say, no, wait a minute. It's about oil and drugs and geopolitics. And then, you know, it gets like too big to eat from the old Rodney Allen Rippy hamburger commercials they used to have in the 70s where this little boy picked up this great big Whopper at Burger King, you know, and he couldn't get his hands. Too big to eat. Well, it's not too big to eat. And that's why you have to make the map work, because all of these things come together and we see them coming together in world events post 9/11. Before I go any further, let me give you a piece of your map which is going to change the way you think about things fundamentally right off the bat. We're going to talk about the Central Intelligence Agency. You're going to know why. Well, this is very important because I'm going to give you a piece of a map that you'd never seen before, probably never thought of before. The Central Intelligence Agency is not what you see on television, and it certainly ain't what you see in the movies. It was created in 1947 by the National Security Act of 1947. Now, the National Security Act of 1947 was written by a man by the name of Clark Clifford. Clark Clifford was a good friend to LBJ and to Harry Truman. He was Secretary of Defense under LBJ. But his real profession was that he was a Wall Street lawyer and a banker. As a matter of fact, in 1990 or so, Clark Clifford is the man who brought a very legendary drug bank called BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, onto American shores before it was exposed as laundering hundreds of billions of dollars of drug money. And he brought that bank to America. That's just one connection. But then we go to two brothers, John Foster and Alan Dulles. John Foster Dulles was the Secretary of State for Dwight Eisenhower. Alan Dulles, he'd been the OSS station chief in Bern, Switzerland. That's the spy forerunner of CIA going back to World War II. Alan Dulles was the CIA director under Eisenhower and John Kennedy. John Kennedy fired Alan Dulles. And Alan Dulles wound up running the Warren Commission after John Kennedy was assassinated. Nothing suspicious there. Now, they designed the CIA. They told Clark Clifford how to write it. They collaborated with it. Guess what their profession was? They were both Wall Street lawyers at the Wall Street law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, which is today probably the single most powerful law firm on Wall Street. It's, by the way, the firm that represents Enron. Nothing suspicious there. If we go a little further, we come to a guy by the name of Bill Casey. And during Iran-Contra, Bill Casey was Ronald Reagan's CIA director. He was creepy. Kill the commies, smoke the cigars, do anything dirty and nasty you got to win the war. And one thing that's unusual about Bill Casey is that under his tenure as DCI, DCI, by the way, is the Director of Central Intelligence, American cocaine consumption went from about 75, 80 metric tons in 1979 to 600 metric tons at the peak of the Contra War in 1987. Bill Casey was tied to all kinds of dirty, corrupt things. He died in office. He had a brain tumor. But you'll never guess what Bill Casey did before he was DCI. For Richard Nixon, he was chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, the U.S. government body that polices all stock transactions. If you've been following the market lately, that might be a little suspicious to you. But it's going to get worse real quick. Because when Bill Casey was DCI, he had a general counsel at CIA by the name of Stanley Sporkin. That's the top lawyer at CIA. And guess what Stanley Sporkin's job had been before he went to the CIA? Well, he was the general counsel for the Securities and Exchange Commission. Oh my God, we're starting to have what we call clues building up here. Now, if you go a little bit further, the general counsel at the CIA, after Stanley Sporkin left in the late 80s, was a guy by the name of David Daugherty. Now, guess what David Daugherty does today? David Daugherty is the executive vice president of the New York Stock Exchange for enforcement. And then we have a guy today in the number three position at CIA headquarters. His name is A.B. Buzzy Krongard. A.B. Buzzy Krongard joined the CIA in 1998, and he was promoted to X-Deer, that's what they call him at CIA, in January of 2001 by President Bush. Buzzy Krongard was an investment banker. He headed a firm called Alex Brown, which was acquired by Bankers Trust and then by Deutsche Bank, and it's now the private banking arm of Deutsche Bank to handle mega-wealthy clients. So, as a matter of fact, guess what? Six out of the first seven DDIs, that's the second highest position at CIA, Deputy Director of Intelligence, went directly from Wall Street to the CIA. Now, I bet you're starting to look at the CIA in a whole new light now, aren't you? I hope so. Now, if we come a little further, let's talk a little bit about oil. And here I have to tip my hat to a great journalist by the name of Seymour Hersh, who has broken a great many stories in his long career. Hersh has been a little soft on 9/11, but just before the attacks on 9/11, you know what? He wrote an incredible story in the New Yorker magazine called The Price of Oil. What he did was he documented how after the fall of the Soviet Union, almost all of the world's major oil companies, and here I'm talking about Chevron, Texaco. By the way, did you know that Condoleezza Rice, our national security advisor, came to the Bush administration from Chevron, and guess what her area of expertise was? Kazakhstan. That's in Central Asia, right next to where we're fighting right now. Chevron, Texaco, BP, Amoco, Exxon Mobil, Total, Fina, Elf, the biggest of the big oil companies, all sunk billions and billions, there's that Sagan thing again, billions and billions of dollars into Central Asia to buy, bribe, whatever they had to do, equity rights, into the largest remaining untapped oil and gas reserves on the planet. Now, they had a couple of problems. First of all, as Cy Hersh documented brilliantly, ExxonMobil bribed the president of Kazakhstan, which is a violation of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. They also, in 1997, because they couldn't get any of the oil out, you know, you have to have like a pipeline or something to get the oil out of there, they engaged in an illegal oil swap with Iran because we can't do business with Iran. They did that in 97. But the problem was this, that all of these major, big old, huge, monster oil companies had committed, I mean, hundreds of billions of dollars in cash to own oil, to develop oil in Central Asia, but they couldn't get any of it to market, meaning they couldn't monetize the investment. They couldn't build a pipeline north through Russia. There was the Russian mob there. It was unstable. The Russian government wanted to control the area that had once been part of the Soviet Union. It was too expensive and too long because the major markets were in China and Japan. They couldn't build a pipeline west because you would have had to go through Chechnya and Georgia and Azerbaijan and Iran. Well, you can't go through Iran. That's illegal. And you would have had to go through all these territories like Kosovo, maybe, that are all full of rebels and very unstable. No way you could do that because your pipeline would probably be blown up. And you couldn't go east. 6,000-7,000 miles across China was just too far to go. But you could go south. It was only 11, 12, 1300 miles from the rich gas fields in Turkmenistan and the Tengiz oil fields and the other oil fields in Kazakhstan to go south to the Pakistani coast where you could put it all on tankers because the U.S. controls the high seas, sail it around to China and Japan and control the sale of it and make all the money from it. The only problem was you had to go directly through Afghanistan. But the plan had been there. Now, we talk in our lectures, and it's extremely well documented in the Congressional Record, in any number of books, in the contracts are still in existence, that Unocal had had contracts to develop pipelines south across Afghanistan or a gas pipeline in a southeasterly direction. Now, there was another little wrinkle in this problem here, in that there was a company called Enron. You've heard of them, I hope. I hope you didn't have any stock in Enron. Enron had put $3 billion in cash to build an electrical generating station in the city of Dabhol, India, that would service Bombay. They were going to get their cheap gas from Qatar. But in 1998, that deal fell through. They lost access to the Qatari gas. But they had a plan to build a gas pipeline in a southeasterly direction across Afghanistan from Turkmenistan to connect up to the Indian pipeline system at the Indian border. And that was the only way that the Dobhole generating station could have ever generated profitably enough energy to sell. The Indian government wouldn't let it do it any other way. It was not feasible. And Enron was in deep trouble because everybody realized there was only one problem to turning all this oil and gas into money, and it was called the Taliban. Now, surprisingly, for a long period of time throughout the Clinton years and into the early part of the Bush administration, although the cards were pretty much cast by that time, people had tried to cultivate the Taliban. The BBC told us that in 1997, UNICAL flew representatives of the Taliban down to their Texas headquarters for a barbecue. Hey, come on down. We'll do a sheep and we'll figure out how to do this pipeline. We'll cook up the sheep real good. And we'll, you know what? It didn't work. The Taliban wanted too much money. Apparently, that's what the BBC story said. But the Taliban also wanted to take oil and gas out for use by the Afghani people in Afghanistan. So in that context, the Taliban proved to be a major stumbling block. And in 1998, a guy named John Maresca, who was an executive vice president of UNICAL, testified in Congress that until the Taliban was removed, none of the pipelines were going to get built. Now, in 1998, Bill Clinton launched some cruise missiles at the Taliban, and UNICAL backed out. They just said, we're not going to get this pipeline built. And on the face of it, you might think, okay, well, gee, that's an interesting part of the story. Okay, I'm understanding now, because we have documented it from the wilderness now. This is being taped in the late summer of 2002. And what we know now is that Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Pakistan, Afghanistan, they are all signing contracts and treaties to build pipelines hand over fist. The World Bank has opened offices in the region to help fund the pipelines. Turkmenistan, Pakistan, and Afghanistan have just signed a three-country treaty, which you can read online. You can find it at our website, to complete the natural gas pipeline by January of 2005. That's about 2 years. The oil pipelines are being discussed, and there's a flurry of activity all throughout the region. I wish I could tell you that it was just that simple, but it's not. Also, what you need to understand is that there was a book written about 5 years ago in 1997 by Zbigniew Brzezinski. He was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor. He's a professor at Johns Hopkins. He also was an intelligence advisor to Ronald Reagan and to George Bush, the first. And he is also a co-founder with David Rockefeller of the Trilateral Commission. If you don't know what the Trilateral Commission, you ought to take a moment to look it up on the web. Very, very powerful, influential, moneyed people. And this book, the book is called The Grand Chessboard, American Primacy and Its Geostrategic Imperatives. Zbigniew Brzezinski, B-R-Z-E-Z-I-N-S-K-I, is how you spell his last name. And you can find it on any major book site. He says very clearly that the key to America's primacy in the 21st century is the control of the Eurasian continent. Now, that's everything from Eastern Europe all the way to the Pacific Ocean, moving east across Russia and China. It is all of the Middle East and includes most of the Indian subcontinent and all of Central Asia. That's Eurasia, is what he calls it. And he says the key to controlling Eurasia is the control of Central Asia, specifically Uzbekistan. But what he's talking about is that little cluster of nations that we all call the stands. Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, all of the stands. But he says Uzbekistan's the key, Afghanistan and Pakistan as well. And Uzbekistan is just north of Afghanistan, and it's coincidentally the first place where Bush officially announced that we were sending troops after the attacks on the World Trade Center. We were already there, as a matter of fact. Leaving that aside, Brzezinski said, and he writes throughout the book about pipelines and pipelines and pipelines, but he also says important minerals including gold and resources and wealth and so on and so forth. And he talks about how China desperately needs the oil and gas. Early on in the book, he says, American popular support for World War II occurred largely because of the shock effect of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Later on, he says that democracy is inimical to imperial mobilization, that the sudden threat, the sudden insecurity, the sudden fearfulness that is necessary to mobilize a populist democracy to basically scare the poop out of them. That's basically what he said. And later on, toward the end of the book, he says clearly that the public would not support the military intervention necessary to accomplish these tasks without a massive and widely perceived direct external threat. Now, all this information is on my website. You can read the quotes and everything else. It's all right there. But what's even scarier about this book, The Grand Chessboard, is that you get it, you open it up, you look at it, and there's a map in there of where the next world conflict is going to be. And the map is, boom, right smack dab, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, right where we are now. He says that's the place where the battle to control the world is going to take place. And that's a five-year-old map. So that would kind of rub against the notion that, gee, in 98, the Taliban just got out of hand and da-da-da-da-da, because Brzezinski clearly indicates that this war is being planned for a long time, and there are other events which indicate that it has been. For example, isn't it strange that on September the 11th, we had Operation Swift Sword, which the British had planned for 4 years, and it was the largest British deployment of troops since the Falkland Islands War, the largest armada since the Falkland Islands War. All the troops were in place, the ships were ready to leave harbor, and it was all set to go, been planned for 4 years, on September the 10th, before the attack. Isn't it strange that in Operation Bright Star, in Egypt, we had 17,000 U.S. troops, along with 23,000 NATO troops in Egypt, locked and loaded, already with their tanks and guns and everything already in place in Egypt. Isn't it strange also that two U.S. aircraft carrier battle groups just happened to be sitting right off the Pakistani coast on what was not a normal rotation? That's what they call it when one carrier battle group trades with another. But that's not where they usually did it, but they just happened to both be there at the same time, sitting off the Pakistani coast. Some of these things make you start to raise questions. By the time you're through listening to all of what we do here, you're going to say, wait a minute, I have to revise my map. Because if you have to revise your map, then you have to undertake certain other things. It becomes incumbent upon you to change the way you view, act, and swim in the ocean that you call your world. You can't swim with the fish like you used to swim once you know this stuff. That's my purpose, because we can change the world, because the world is not a healthy place to live anymore.